Golf courses are made for playing golf. Tennis courts are made for tennis matches. And prisons are made for escaping.
Hiroshima.
Do you know French?
I know enough French to be dangerous. Like, you know, be in France and not understand what anybody's saying to me. But I've been around enough French.
Okay.
And I was surprised watching this again that I was like, oh, right, I understood that, you know. Eric von Stroheim's French was very clear. So.
Yeah. I'd like to get to that after German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I studied ancient Greek, so I could relate to
it. I didn't even know that was available.
Well, let's see. I studied it in college for a summer at Brooklyn College. They have a Latin and Greek program.
Okay.
And, you know, that was a long time ago. It was like a 10-week, it was like they covered 3 years of, no, 10 years of ancient Greek. No, 3 years of ancient Greek, sorry, in 10 weeks. So it was like this cram. And then I transferred up to SUNY, actually. So I went up in Albany.
SUNY Albany?
Yeah. Okay. They didn't really have an ancient Greek. They had a classics department and you could do an independent study. And, you know, I lost most of my Greek. I still know the alphabet and I can read phonetically, which is kind of freaky, you know, and I, you know, have a lot of cognates that I recognize.
Yep.
But yeah, you're not going to catch me conversing in ancient Greek with a classicist.
Well, you want to get this started?
Yeah.
All right.
Chew this train.
Hello, Jellyheads, and welcome to another exciting episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In. We are your hosts, David Halstead and
Lucas Wilson,
and with our guest host,
Colleen Lovett.
Thank you for
first
being
time
on.
Guest.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
We've been like through the gauntlet of our reoccurring guests.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to get a fresh face in.
Excellent.
Always good.
Always excellent. Good. Always good.
Yes. Tap people we've worked with on various projects.
Yeah.
And this is the show where we discuss the strange, the obscure, the B-cult, or classic films. And tonight, what are we discussing?
La Grande Illusion.
Frou, 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 frou. C'est pendant le commandant qui rentre sous la fence, vous êtes ici sous l'autorité des lois allemandes. Station d'évasion, les sentinelles ont ordre de tirer sur tout officier surpris en dehors des limites.
D'un côté des enfants qui jouent aux soldats, et de l'autre des soldats qui jouent comme des enfants.
Alors, messieurs, par quoi désirez-vous commencer? Poulet froid, pâté de foie gras aux truffes du Périgord ou maquereau mariné du capitaine Cook?
Arrêtez les copains! On a repris du roman. Et c'est eux-mêmes qui l'annoncent.
Bravo! Bravo!
Contre nous de la tyrannie.
Compte de tennis, ça joue au tennis. À compte prisonnier, ça sert à s'évader.
Je suis désolé de vous voir ici. Ce qui pince, mon vieux, c'est pas la musique, c'est pas les instruments. C'est le bruit des pas.
You understand that if you do not obey my order now, I'll have to shoot.
Was machen Sie hier?
Français. Französin. Verstehen?
Otherwise known as The Grand Illusion.
You certainly have better French pronunciation than either of us.
I can
we'll leave
fake
that.
It
we'll
so
leave
well.
That all up to you.
Yeah, there was a reason I didn't want to be the one to say it.
Grand Illusion works. And it's the director is Jean Renoir, who I believe was actually the painter Renoir's son.
Really?
Yeah, pretty sure. You could Google it just to be sure. I don't want to like, spread misinformation. But
son
I'm pretty
of
sure.
famous impressions.
Ah, oui.
Son of the famous Impressionist painter Pierre Auguste, Pierre Renoir was his brother. Or Piero. I don't know. I'm getting lost in myself. If you haven't run away already, fire is still the conversation. You can also find us in other podcasts at psychotrailerfish.com. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and the podcast app Stitcher. Please rate and view. It really does help with the show. And if you happen to be a fan, might I suggest you follow us facebook.com/psychojellyfish or on Twitter at Jellycast.
But enough of that. We're here to talk about movies. Le Grand Illusion is a 1937 French World War I drama directed by Jean Renoir. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Renoir.
I'm American.
Renoir.
Well, anyways, it follows captured French soldiers as they attempt to escape from a German from various German POW camps, actually, right?
Yes.
Yep.
There's a bit of a montage there at point where they're going through. It's like, and then they were sent to this one, and then this one, and then this one.
They took it pretty seriously, this escaping business.
Mm-hmm.
At least Maréchal and Debordieu did. It sounds like they were together for a lot of the time.
Oh, two eventually do escape from a castle fortress run by the sympathetic Captain von Raffenstein, played by Erich von Stroheim. And after hiding out for a time on a German...
Stein.
Hey, I was in the middle of it. You can't interrupt that.
Raffenstein.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stein. Stroheim? Raffenstein? Why'd they even give him a character name?
Von Raffenstein.
Let me get through this summary.
The V's are F's in German most of the time.
You speak the German, I write the summary. And after hiding out for a time on a German widow's farm, they make their way to Switzerland. I can't read and speak very well at the same time. I should probably send these summaries to Lucas, but he would be all over the place. Like,
and then they escaped to the prison.
The film is less about the war and more about individuals and relationships formed under those dire circumstances. The title seems to suggest that people's differences based on nationality or class are nothing more than a grand illusion, that our humanity connects us even when war divides us, and it is a tragedy we kill and oppress each other over artificial boundaries.
Huh.
That is very apt for World War I.
Yes. Every time I see a World War I movie, I'm just sitting there going, what are they fighting over?
Yeah, everybody seems to like each other, you know?
Yeah, that's
at least in this movie.
Yeah, that's the... I was talking to Colleen earlier. I was like, oh, it's always interesting to see, like, you know, a movie or something take place in World War I, because you don't hear that very often. Mm-hmm. It gets very overshadowed by World War II, but also because World War II, there's, like... You can play with the good guy, bad guy thing. I mean, things are a hell of a lot more complicated than that, mm-hmm. but like, we all agree that Nazis were not very, right. not a benefit to have around. But World War I, everybody was just like.
No, Lucas, a beanbag chair is not a benefit to have around. Nazis were bad guys.
They were the baddies. But, you know, so it's interesting about that quote you said. I was going to say something similar, like, and so the grand illusion is, but I kind of half agree with that analysis because it's like, yes, the illusion, I think the illusion is that it was, you know, France and England versus Germany versus, you know, I think the illusion was that they were all divided by the countries they came from. But what really connected them was, yes, their humanity ultimately, but their class, like what class they belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when the first time you realize it, the first time, you know, when the French captain and his lieutenant, their plane is downed by von Raffenstein, he, you know, there's this clearly this recognition is established, like, hey, you know, I'm an aristocrat, you're an aristocrat, I know your cousin, you know, we're going to speak English to each other, I'm going to treat you with the utmost respect. And that's sort of, you know, even grows, you know, the next time, you know, in the last prison that they're in where he's in charge of it, it even goes farther in the with the special treatment and so forth. And DeBill Jew is always like, hey, well, what about the rest of my guys? You know, but yeah. he is able to connect with him as a member of that class. But he also has this sense of, you know, we're all French here and we all have each other's backs. So
mm-hmm. That opening scene was interesting because I was like, I didn't know what this really was all going to be about and mm-hmm. stuff. And it just starts off and I was like kind of confused at first. Cause, like people were speaking French and German at the same time
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they're all sitting down to have dinner together.
Right. They've just been captured.
Yeah. They've just been captured. Yeah. But like, here, come have some dinner. And then this guy's got a reef for like some other pilot that died that was French. And mm-hmm. it was like, oh, yeah. World War One is very different.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the pilot class mm-hmm. in particular, they, you know, that was like, it was like a, you know, an aristocratic thing, even though, mm-hmm. it, you know, so, but in the French pilots were from all the French officers were from different, ultimately, you know, were from different classes. You know, Maréchal was more of an engineer, middle class guy. I guess they weren't all airmen. Once they met up with the other French prisoners, you know, I don't know what parts of the military they were from, but they were definitely from different parts of French society. You know, like the wealthy Rosenthal. There was a wealthy family, an actual wealthy family in France, the Rothschilds that, you know, are, you know, there's like famous wine that they made. Uh-huh. And they're really like, you know, they're Jewish, first of all, and they're new money. And that's sort of the aristocrats look down on that, like, oh, you're, you know, that's so common, you know, to be business class, to be, you know, to have your money, your wealth so new. I mean, mm-hmm. we're very used to that in America. We're a lot of self-made
yeah.
people. We don't have as much old
infant
money.
Country.
So you get this like cross-section of French, you know, French society at the time, in the prison, but they're all French, you know.
But they do bond even through those class distinctions because they're all French and together in this prison camp.
Yes.
And the rich French aristocrat guy mm-hmm. ends up sacrificing himself so the other guys can get away.
Yes. And so it's, you know, and he says, it's interesting because I think it's kind of a paradox because you, let me know if I'm talking too much.
While you're here.
It's a podcast.
It's a podcast, we're crying out loud.
It's a pod.
Well, you know, he says, you know, his lieutenant, Maréchal, he's like, keeps trying to like say like, thank you. Like, dude, thanks, you know, like, I love you, man, you know. But De Belge is very reserved. And he even says, he's like, you know, and Marshall's like, hey, you know, like, we don't have anything in common. You're so formal with me. You always stand on ceremony. So there's still that wall. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, so I'm doing this for you. Don't take it personally. It's also for me because that's his last heroic act. And that's sort of an aristocratic thing. So he's kind of between both of those worlds. You know, he's, you know, it's like this honorable death that he has. You know, it's a good solution for men like us.
An aristocratic version of Lieutenant Dan.
I don't know who Lieutenant Dan is.
Yeah, Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump. Yes. He's the one who's like, I've got to die in a war.
Yes, yes, yes. And my father and his father before him. And so then they do like the generations. It's like hilarious.
Oh, it's absurd.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he's sort of like, he's still part of that world, even though he knows it's crumbling and he knows that the new order of things is more egalitarian. He likes the other guys on his crew and in the prison with him, but, you know, he still kind of stands on his own. He says, Maréchal's like, you know, you smoke these fancy cigarettes. We, you know, we can't really talk about the same things and you're so formal with me. And De Beaudieu says, I use the vous with the formal you with my wife and my mother too.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, don't take it personally. This is how I am. You know, my whole life I stand on ceremony. He's not one of the guys ultimately.
He even dies in that ceremonial way where he tells Stroheim to turn away and not look at him, you know, finally pass.
Right.
Which is very similar to almost exactly the same as a moment from another film we just watched.
Once Upon a Time
in the West.
Ooh, really? Oh, interesting.
With Jason Robards' character is dying at the end and he tells Charles Bronson's character to turn away.
Oh, wow. Preserve his dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's almost exactly the same. I must
imagine Leone saw this.
That film is filled with references, but they're usually to American Westerns.
Mm.
But that, I have a hard time believing it didn't come from this.
Sure, sure, yeah. I was surprised. Well, I'm not totally surprised. I was like 20 when I first saw it. You know, it was a long time ago. I'm not going to say how long, but I have a teenage kid, so I'm like trying to explain this movie to him, and he's like, "Whatever, mom." Yeah. Yeah, like there's a lot of exposition in the second part. It's like, yes, we don't get along because we're from different classes. And, you know, and, but then, you know, there's these friendships forming, like Rosenthal and Marischal, the guys who escaped together. So they develop their special bond, and, Baldieu and Raffenstein have their special bond that's all about mutual respect and everything. So you kind of get to see those in parallel.
It's interesting. It's, this film has this message and the grand illusion. You know, it's this anti-war thing, but it's never preachy, really. And it's never like whiny sort of like, can't we all just get along? It's very much just, it's not really even focused on the war. It's focused on the characters.
Yep. Yeah. When I read that anti-war description, I was like, really? You know, didn't really think of it as
well. As
that.
A professor of mine, I took war literature in class, and we watched a lot of war movies. And he said, it's like most war stories are inherently anti-war. If you're realistically, right. You're saying this is what happens in war.
Right.
There's a lot of negativity in that.
Right. Like All Quiet on the Western Front. That's the obvious example where it's like, wow, trench warfare sucks. You know, and you really
absolutely.
Saw that one in college.
But this, I wouldn't classify this necessarily as a war film. Like Platoon is a movie that's about the war. You know, a bunch of World War II movies. It's like there's that plot driven. You know, we got to fight. You know, it's very goal driven. You know,
right?
It's like we got to win. We got to fight. But yeah. Even Saving Private Ryan is very much, you know, has this momentum of we have this goal to accomplish, right? Whereas this, their goal is to escape, but there's no real plot to this thing. It's just focused on the characters.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, I kept thinking of The Hurt Locker when I was watching this. Because that seemed to me very much focused on the character instead of the war.
Right. And they're in such good spirits, or they seem to be, you know, you know, when they come to the, when they're first united with the other French prisoners, and they put that show on, you know, they get the costumes and they have that guy come out dressed
okay.
up.
Okay. I have to ask about that moment.
Yeah.
When the guy comes out dressed in drag and they all stop and just silently looking at me, he's just going, this is funny, right? Isn't this funny? Right. And it's like, none of these men have seen a woman in a long time.
Exactly. And that's when you remember, you're like, oh, right. They're in a war camp. They're prisoners of war. Yeah. That's like, you're kind of reminded like, oh yeah, these guys are really still trying to survive, even though it's not, concentration camp conditions necessarily, but it's still, they're cut off
still
from their families.
Yeah.
Yep. They don't even know that skirts got short or shorter. Oh, and that, you know, and then when they do the play, again, this is the nationalism, Baldieu's nationalism and Marischal's nationalism. He's like, yeah, you know, I don't like theater, but let's do this show. And, you know, I wrote the battle down. The French were just defeated.
Was it Verdun?
No, it's
Verdun was mentioned at this.
It's like Douaumont, Douaumont. So the Germans occupied Douaumont, and they're like bummed. So they're like, all right, we're doing the show. And so then while the show is going on, Marischal runs in with the news that the French have retaken it. And then they throw him in solitary confinement. And then they break into the Marseillaise. And I'm like, yes, it's not just Casablanca where you get a rousing, you know, rendition of the Marseillaise. So I thought that was cool. But of course, then the French lose it again. They lose.
Yeah, that kind of highlights the futility of that war, because it was just.
Yeah, and when they find out they lost it again, you know, it's like they were so like amped when they won it back. It's like, yeah! And then when they lost again, it's like, ah, what's the point of any of this?
Yeah, and then Marshall loses his mind in solitary confinement almost, you know. He just gets
catatonic. I love
how
the German guard comes in and comforts him. He's yes. like, there, there, it's all right.
Have some cigarettes, have a harmonica, you know.
Also, in that first concentration camp, there's this. It's just me, or could you always tell who the Germans were because they had mustaches?
Yes, they're Hun mustaches. I don't know if they called them concentration camps. But
did I say concentration?
Yeah,
you said concentration camp.
Instead of prisoner of war camp?
I meant to say prisoner of war camp. Sorry. That was a slip.
It sounded like the French were treated better than the Russians in the.
Yes.
Camps too.
Likely.
Seemed to be the case
it
as well.
Seemed like it, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, like, the English were just in the middle.
Singing It's a Long Way from Tipperary. Or well, I wouldn't have mind having as my prison mate someone who was getting regular shipments of, like, cheese and wine and caviar from their wealthy family in France.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
Yeah, that's like something you wouldn't really expect these days at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're a prisoner of war. Here's your care package from your family.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, even though it's, you know, we're not in World War II territory yet, you know, you see anti-Semitism in the film, and Rosenthal is Jewish, and also, what's his, Demolday. He's the one. When they arrive at the castle prison, I think he's the third officer, and he's the one who has all these books, and he studies Pindar, and he's, you know, studies Latin. And, when their room is being, inspected, and they have to, like, hide the rope that they're tying together to escape with, he's reading Pindar, and, you know, they grab it from him, and he gets all upset. He's like, that's a rare book, da da da. And Raffenstein comes up and holds his chin up and looks at him in profile, like, establishing that he's Jewish, and he's like, poor old Pindar, that, you know, basically I'm saying that you would be reading him. So so von Raffenstein he embodies this old school thinking, which, you know, also includes anti-Semitism, you know, whereas there's more of a feeling of equality amongst all the French in this. Another cool thing is when he's giving the tour of the castle, you know, I mean, they're prisoners and he's giving them a tour. And, I think it's Demolday again. He's saying like, oh, you know, he's whispering to Marichal, that's 12th century. You know, and they go to another section. He's like, that's 13th century. And then they're watching von Raffenstein walk off and he points to the arch. He's like, that's 14th century. And Baljeu goes, it's purely Gothic. And you're sort of looking at von Raffenstein. He's referring, one guy's referring to the architecture. The other one's referring to the man. Oh. And that he really is. I mean, that's like hundreds of years of this tradition of aristocracy. So he is 12th century all the way up to the present moment. And he kind of embodies all that, you know, with his white gloves. And Baljeu has white gloves too, because they're both, you know, they're both white glove guys, jazz hands, you know.
Fancy hands, can't touch things. Fancy hands.
And he has that flower in the castle.
Yes, the geranium.
Because it's like the only like type of flower that will grow around there or something.
Well,
it was like the subtitle went by too fast on that one.
I think the notion was that most flowers die there, but he was able to keep this one alive. And he said only like nettles and ivy thrive here. You know, the implication there is to him, Debaldieu is like this geranium. You know, he's like this last vestige of you know, what he considers to be aristocracy and refinement.
Yeah, a flower that's valued over other flowers, a person that's valued as sort of like more important in society.
Yes. I mean, that castle is sort of like, you know, a representation of that character in so many ways, you know. The history and the rigidness. You know, he's got the rigid back. You know, every time he takes a drink, his entire.
Oh yeah, because he's got the back brace on.
Yeah, right. And even in the beginning, he's got some kind of like weird spine thing going on. It's very stiff.
Yeah, but
and
in
rigid.
The beginning, he has less going on. You can tell like he's moving around a lot more in the beginning, and then when you cut to him as the guard of the castle, he's clearly had an accident because he has that thing around his chin and everything.
Yep.
He says he's burned over most of his body.
His knees replaced.
He probably got shot down.
Yeah, because in the beginning, he was a pilot.
That's right. That's right. So I guess he got a promotion, or maybe because he was injured. He was sort of mourning that he's like, I used to be a soldier, a fighter. Now I'm just a functionary.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
I'm just a prison administrator.
Administrating.
But, you know, and when they showed up, he's like, well, I'm going to run this prison by French rules. Here's the book. You can, you know, review it and just see that we're sticking to the rules. We're not going to be bad to you. We're going to follow you by the same way you treat your prisoners of war, which I don't know if that's a good thing or not.
I guess that would contrast to the beginning when they were like, this is German rules and you're going to do everything that any German tells you to do.
Right. After you finish your lovely lunch.
Yeah.
Well, under the French rules, they escape.
That's true. It actually works. And I'd forgotten that last third or so, you know, when they do escape, how much they suffered. You know, you're like, oh, I'm sad that they're leaving, you know, Lottie and her mother, but like, yeah, get out of there. Get to Switzerland already. It's like, you're like, oh my God, thank God, you know, they're in danger of at every turn freezing and
like to remind the audience that the war is going on. They'll have like soldiers march by and like knock on the door.
Oh yeah. Where's blah blah blah? It's 12 miles up the road. 12 miles.
Yeah, they got lucky. They got lucky that they hid in her shed.
Yeah,
and she's like, yeah, I'm all alone. Come on in my house.
Yeah, and they have this sort of family dynamic that happens for a little while before they run off to Switzerland, not to just be safe in Switzerland, but they want to get back into the war. Right. They want to get back over to the French side.
Yeah, I don't know if they want to go back fighting to the war, again. But...
Did they want
That's
to,
what
or, were they,
saying.
Or were they talking about, like, well, we leave, we're just going to end up back in this mess.
They kind of know it's inevitable. I don't know if it's what they desire. They just don't want to be...
Yeah, because the thing they were talking about is, like, we should probably go. They're going, like, but we'll just end up back where we started.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't want to go through all that again.
And something about, like, I think, like, he said he'd come back for her, but then he's like, well, you're just going to end up in the war again.
Yeah. Right, so why are you telling her that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a kind of anti-war thing, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, if this were like an American blockbuster movie, it'd be like, and then 10 years later, he's in Paris and she's in Paris and they run into each other and they, you know.
It's the prologue, yeah.
Alfred sees Batman in Paris. Yeah, it would have been exactly that.
It was just like that.
Yeah.
The one buddy is, you know, a trip somewhere and then he spots them at a diner. Just like the Dark Knight Rises ending.
It's like, dude, where's my cow? You know, Elsa with her cow and hanging out in Paris.
All them blue eyes.
That's right. Was that before we started recording? We were making fun of.
I don't remember.
Lottie hast blaue Augen.
Lottie hast.
And how they try to teach him German. They teach Marischal German, but he's still kind of.
Yeah, that was interesting because it was like those two had like a thing going, even though they could not understand each other.
Yeah, there was this whole thing about connections despite barriers.
Right. And yet still limitations, too. I was just remembering. In that last prison, you know, Marischal and Rosenthal are looking at the map together, and their one African, I would say French African, prison mate is painting or drawing or something. Mm-hmm. And he comes over and shows him his painting, and he's like, it's called, I finished my painting, it's Justice Pursues Crime. And they just kind of look at him like, whatever. And they go back to what they're doing. So I mean, I really think he was down to the last example showing how French society was, how everybody was there and just mm-hmm. how people ranked. I think the fact that the French guys, they barely acknowledged his presence, you know, so I think he wanted to show that as mm-hmm. well. You know, it's like, okay, so Rauffenstein, you know, looks down on the working and middle class and the Jewish soldiers and they don't give the time of day to their African French African soldier mate.
Yeah, this film has a message and it's very present throughout the entire film, how it's saying this message in various ways and various examples. And yet, unlike a Hollywood film, it's not directly telling you what the message is and beating it over your head. You actually have to think about it and figure it out.
It's true. the beginning of that scene, they're talking about diseases, and like one guy was saying, like, you know, I got, obviously he was saying he got some kind of sexually transmitted disease. WWG is like, oh, you know, that's an honor. Few people contract that anymore. And then they're talking about, like, you know, cancer and gout, you know, it's only in the aristocratic class. He was like, don't worry, other people will start getting it too, you know, as conditions improve. So it's like funny. And then they say, you know, and in this war, all germs are sort of equal, you know. Uh-huh. But yeah, even like based on how you get sick is a reflection of what class you come from, at least there, you know, at that time and in that world.
Yeah, there is something that is kind of lost watching this film today. I can't imagine how strong this was watching it in 1937 on the eve of World War II.
Probably, yeah. I also saw this film in the context of a class that I took in college. It was French politics, and sort of the theme of that course was, you know, the transition from feudalism, you know, lords and serfs and all that, to capitalism. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I remember, I think I actually wrote a paper on this or a final exam on this, which is, you know, how I, you know, I was surprised at how much I remembered, actually.
Well, this is a film where it really does help to have context. Otherwise, you're sitting there and you're good. Not really sure what's going on or why.
It's true. Because, I mean, really, this film is sort of like to say, yes, the transition from feudalism to capitalism is pretty much complete by the time World War I comes around. It's like you still have these vestiges of mm-hmm. the old order. But they're crumbling before your very eyes.
And so it gets the whole continent embroiled in war to begin with. All the ties between aristocratic family. Yeah.
Exactly, and they don't even have. Yeah, I mean, it when you're part of the aristocracy, like country doesn't mean or didn't mean anything. You know, you would have German and French and every ancestry from all over, Danish or whatever. There were no boundaries, you know, national boundaries like that. Mm-hmm. And then Rosenthal, he was saying, oh, you know, they were like, oh, you're from Jerusalem. And he's like, well, actually, I'm from Vienna and Denmark. And that's like still different because it's, you know, the Jewish diaspora, you know, they're just Jewish communities all over the world. So his family is like this microcosm of that.
Yeah.
But it's not the aristocracy. It's a different world. So it's like worlds within worlds, you know?
Yeah. So there's a lot where I was like lost about like, what are they talking about? Cause I didn't have necessarily the historical context in mind when I started watching, but I still connected with these characters as individuals and was able to see how they interacted as a group of people and just being interested in the characters themselves.
Yeah,
especially like when the two do escape, like everything from the castle on, like, was really gripping to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was a lot of context that was, I guess I was missing in the like first half of the film.
Right. Right. It kind of sets them up because now it's just the two of them, you know, and the open road, so to speak, out in the wilderness, and one almost leaves the other, you know, they're hungry and they're cold and they're tired, and, you know, then they have this big fight, and, you know, he says something nasty and anti-Semitic to him, and he's like, well, screw you, you're a jerk, and, you know, and he's sitting there with his foot that's not working, you know, because he probably injured it when they jumped out of, you know, when they scaled the castle prison. But then he comes back because they are pals, like he said. They, you know, they sort of confirm that before they escape together, and then they reconfirm that they really have become good friends and are really taking care of each other.
There is that thing, like, they have it really rough when they first start out to escape, and it's almost like, we might as well be caught and at least we'll get fed back in the prison. They were prisoners, yes, but they weren't being, like, beaten and starved. They had all these perks and everything going on for them, and yet there was still that need for them to escape.
Yeah, it was still demoralizing.
It was almost like it was like, well, we have to escape because it's our duty to escape. It's like not even like questioning that. It's like, should we escape, or will that just get people killed when we when we're not being super mistreated here? Right.
Because prisons are meant to be escaped from. If you're an aristocrat,
it was just like,
particularly.
Well, we got to try to escape. We're in prison, got to try to escape. Yep. That's our duty.
Absolutely.
Yeah, or that a few times where they were talking about how, I think they've even showed other people escaping, and they're like, you get killed if you try to escape. And then at that time when the head prison guy...
Von Raffenstein?
Yeah, mm-hmm. is confronting his French friend...
DeBulge.
Yeah. Running off, and he's like, oh, it's my duty, I have to shoot you. Like, right. I like you, but I'm...
Right.
I'm bound to have to do this anyway. Mm-hmm. Right. So,
still like an honorable, yeah. You know, he's like, I'm just telling you.
It's like duty and all this nationalism, and that nationalism is getting in the way of their humanity, you know, where it's like these people would all actually just get along if there wasn't their countries at war.
Right. They could go on being happy aristocratic friends together, talking in English when they feel like it. It was like,
and
oh,
I guess
he's speaking
back
English.
In 1937, it would have been more profound to, like, say, you know, breaking down barriers between people because our humanity connects us. But that's something I kind of take for granted, so it didn't ever strike me as very mm-hmm. profound. Mm-hmm. I was more interested in the character, like I said, as the characters themselves, you know, what they were going through.
Yeah. The other, like, class of people that I feel like Renoir was highlighting was actors and artists. You know, that one character, mm-hmm. you know, that he passes
writers.
Out. Yeah. Well, they have a character who's like the actor, and he sings that song in the play, in the little show that they put on, and he's the one who passes out digging the tunnel, and they
yeah.
pull him out. You know, when they're talking later, when they're talking about, you know, rich people get cancer and gout, you know, and he's like, hey, what do artists get? And like, we get tuberculosis. Artists and intellectuals get, you know, tuberculosis. I thought, you know, I wasn't into theater and acting back then when I saw it. So it didn't really like make an impression on me like, oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As big and as an impression, it's like, okay.
What led you to like really enjoy this movie? Like what why does it resonate with you?
And yeah. Your... Well, I mean, I studied political theory in college.
Okay.
And so this was part of, and this is political science class, politics mm-hmm. of France. And so, and we watched it. I don't know. I think because it is part of my intellectual awakening, I think, you mm-hmm. know, to like see film as, you know, something that can really represent, in a really artful, interesting way, character-driven way, historical events. Because I always say, like, I'm sort of a fake political science major. Like, I don't really have a mind for dates and, like, oh, the battle of such and such, you know. But I'm more interested in, you know, and was more interested in political theory and philosophy. I was mm-hmm. a philosophy minor. And then doing weird things like studying ancient Greek, which I was telling you about before. But I'm sort of like the guy reading Pindar, you know. So for me, it was like part of my just sort of coming of age as a, you know, a film lover and being open to that whole world. Yeah. And I haven't, you know, I think I watched it maybe once or twice since then, but I hadn't really, you know, just sort of went on with my life. I still love film. I got into film and acting and all of that. It still holds up. I was worried I was going to be like, little bored, like, uh-oh, I'm going to, like, talk about this movie. But no, I love it more, even. And, yeah, you really do get interested in these characters. I mean, actually, you know, it's funny. I was just joking about studying ancient Greek and being, like, the Pindar guy. That quote, you know, I've often gone back to that in my life when I'm, like, if I feel, you know, like, in revealing about myself. But, you know, and when I've been in situations where I'm sort of doubting myself, it's like, oh, you know, who am I to be trying to either pursue this role or write something or, you know, and it's like, poor Pindar. Yeah. Pauvre vieux Pindar, poor old Pindar. But of course, you know, that's not ultimately what I think of myself. You know, it's like, you know, that's the voice of self-doubt.
It's funny how lines from movies will come to you in just your daily experiences. I know living in upstate New York, I sometimes just walk outside and for the past year, I've been going, what a lovely day! What a lovely day!
What is that from?
Mad Max Fury Road.
Because nothing says Mad Max Fury Road like upstate New York.
Well, it's like the weather is always bad. In
oh, that yeah,
moment,
with the nice
the guy's
weather.
Driving into a sandstorm, oh, screaming, what a lovely day.
That's great. One thing I was noticing this time, in the beginning, you know, when they first get shot down, there's this poster on the wall. It's like a German poster, and it's like, you know, watch, like, watch your speech, watch what you say. The enemy is always listening. And then that same poster was in the prison at the end. And I was like, oh, what's that all about? Or is it just like...
The loose lips sink ships?
Yeah, sort of thing. Like that, yeah. That was an interesting bit of stuff, you know.
There are some messages in this that are heavy-handed. At the end, when they're trying to cross over to Switzerland, and they're like, are we in Switzerland yet? Is that the Switzerland border? And the guy's like, well, nature didn't draw borders, man did, or something to that effect. And
I'm like, wait, what?
That's pretty heavy-handed. That's a pretty cheesy line.
Or what about the Russians burning that crate of books when they got pissed that there was no caviar in there? What was that about? He's like... the scholar guy was like, these are perfectly good books. What are you doing? You know, and they're like, rah, you know, we burn books because we're Russian. I don't know what that
books.
Was.
That's the cause of all
oh,
this.
Oh, no. Another Atomic Wasteland reference, Dave. Jeez. Wait, what? Where did that happen where I brought that up? And you're like, did you really just...
I can't remember.
It was another episode. It was like, we were talking about books, and I was just like, books. They're what started all this.
They're the cause of all this.
Yeah, it was a really dumb moment in the movie where, like, it was the antagonist,
New Barbarians,
right?
It's a post-apocalyptic world, and at some point they come across some books, and the guy just rips a book in half and looks across at the wasteland and says, books, they're the cause of all this. And we're like, what? And it's never brought up again.
That was definitely a weird moment.
Like, yeah, but one of the... subtler messages in this film that you might not get from seeing the film is in one of the posters.
That the enemy is always listening.
Oh, no, the poster for the actual film.
Oh, for the Grand Illusion.
Yes, there's this one poster. It's white with this like charcoal drawing of a German soldier. Like the chest area of the soldier is like taken out, and in there's a dove trying to break through barbed wire within the soldier. So it's like, you might not click right away, but it's like, you know, the dove represent peace, but it's wounded, but and it's trying to escape from inside the soldier, from inside the war, but also mm-hmm. inside the individual.
And that soldier who's the guard, the guard who tries to comfort Marichal when he's in solitary, you know, he definitely embodies that, you know, when he leaves the cell and the other soldier's like, well, what's the harmonica music? What's that all about? And he's like, the war is just, he says something like, this war has just gone on too long or something like that.
Yeah, the war's gone on too long.
And he just, yeah, you totally see his empathy. And
it's like, they're just people and their nation said, go fight each other. And they're like, all right, it's what we have to do.
Right, I mean that's the war where they had was it the Christmas Eve truce or something? The Christmas truce,
yeah.
And they had a ceasefire, and then they had like a little party, and then they went back and shot each other.
Well, actually, they had a hard time getting back to shooting each other after that.
I could imagine.
They didn't want to.
Yeah, it would have been interesting if like these two armies were just like, we're not going to fight anymore, and then
the people actually looked at the aristocracy and said, we're not going to kill each other over your disagreement. You
right.
know, that's insanity.
Work it out yourselves. Have a tennis match for crying out loud. Or go play golf.
There was no reason for World War One to happen, and it's so insane.
Kaiser Wilhelm be damned.
France, another one man. That the insanity of World War One is Paths of Glory.
Is that a movie?
Yeah. So either of you seen that one?
No.
I did not see it.
It's Kirk Douglas, directed by Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, okay.
Set in World War One, and the generals are going over their plans. This one guy's trying to make a good impression, like, I've got this plan. And they're like, well, that won't work. But our boys will make it work. And at the front, they get, you know, Kirk Douglas gets the plan, and he's to attack, and he's like, that won't work. But they have to go through with it anyways, and of course they all get, you know, slaughtered except for the few guys who retreat. And the guys who retreated, because there was no possible way they were ever going to win by doing that, what the generals were actually doing was sort of like sacrificing this one whole troop so they could use another troop to come in from another angle. You know, just, it was a strategy that involved just sacrificing a whole group of troops. And the ones who retreated were then put on trial for having retreated and executed.
Interesting.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kubrick.
It's the mechanisms of, you know, what, you know, like that duty and the nationalism is what, you know, they have to be executed because they retreated.
Right. You know, I was just thinking the other sort of subgenre that it is also hard to fit this film in, but you think it's a good candidate, is the World War One airplane themed film, like The Blue Max. Have you heard of that one?
No.
Let's see if I, and then there was one that David Niven was in it, which was fairly famous, but I'm forgetting the name. It's about a bunch of World War One pilots. Something, I think it's got the word dawn in it. I'll see if I can find it. But I don't know, does that ring a bell to you?
A lot of dawn movies come to mind, but none that have to do with World War One.
From dusk till dawn.
Red Dawn.
Right. I'm going to see if I can find it. But The Blue Max, I think, was a German movie about a World War One.
Well, you actually never see the planes or any of the war in this.
Right. It's all off screen.
It is a lot of exposition. It's people talking about the war going on, which for some is like how the war must have been experienced, you know?
The Dawn Patrol, 1938.
I have heard of that.
Yeah. Scott, I guess? Oh, no. Scott was the character that David Niven played, because I'm looking at his IMDb profile. Dawn Patrol.
Off topic, but apparently Hanks and Spielberg are making another World War II miniseries, but it's all about the air pilots.
Oh, okay.
That should be interesting. Yeah. I liked Band of Brothers.
Oh, I didn't watch that, but I heard it was really good. Good.
I saw some of that, but I never saw the whole thing.
I mean, it's kind of depressing, so it's to get through it all is...
Well, yeah.
I'll watch
war.
It. I'll be like, depressing. Thanks, Lucas.
It's good. It's really good. Yeah. I haven't seen The Pacific. I hear that one's like, it's pretty good, but not as good as Band of Brothers.
I really want to see Bridge of Spies.
I know somebody who was in that.
Really?
Someone local? Ron something. Oh. He's worked with us a couple times at Clipcentric, but he was telling us how he was one of the Supreme Court justices.
Oh, fun.
In the scene in that movie.
Very cool.
He's like, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, the pictures prove it.
Is it one of those pictures where it's like a bunch of like famous people in the front and then this blurred face in the background? And he's like, that's me.
I swear it's me. Yeah. Well, one thing I've wanted to do that I haven't done over the years is like...
Star in a Spielberg film.
No. Well, hey, that goes without saying. But, you know, like take like the actor who plays the lieutenant, the French lieutenant, Jean Gabin is his name. So it's like, oh, I'd like to see other films that he's been in, or Eric von Stroheim. Yeah, which I'm sure I've seen him in more things than I recall. But he's
Sunset
really
Boulevard.
Famous. Oh, that's right. Yeah, and what else did Renoir do? You know, I don't know. You know, I haven't really
Renoir
really explore.
Did some really really good films.
Oh yeah,
The Lower Depths. If you haven't seen, you should check out. It actually stars the same guy,
the French guy,
the same girl too. It's the German girl and the French guy.
Yep, Jean Gabin, and I forget her name now. I was just looking up. The one who plays Elsa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Might not
Dita
be her.
Dita Parlow?
Yeah. Well, I think she's the only woman in this movie.
Yeah.
Nearly a grown-up woman, not counting Lottie.
Not her.
No, it wasn't her. I was looking at that.
Lying to the audience, Dave.
Mm.
Well, if you look at the poster for it, it's like, is that her? No, it's just similar-looking woman.
Right.
So... You would encourage people to seek this film out if they have an interest in World War One, or
I think so, or in film history.
In film history, yeah.
Yeah, because I think, you know, that's definitely an interesting period of film.
Like, what would you tell someone if you wanted them to see this film? Like, see this film because...
I would say, well, I think it's a great part of, like, you know, if someone's, like, interested in film, if someone's sort of like if I saw... met, you know, you, for example, which I have, I would say, oh, you would love The Grand Illusion. You know, it's got this fascinating thing. And you know, I learned, you know, I tend to go for things that have like extra bang for their buck. So it's like, I love all of that, you know, exploration of the, you know, the different classes and how it stands out so much, mm-hmm. you know, and Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to sort of separate all my associations with it, you know, because I was watching it and I was just like, you know, laughing at certain parts, you know, that I remembered and just the way they comment to each other. Yeah, I don't know. It would be this, like, what, for example, why, how would you recommend Casablanca to somebody? You know, I kind of feel like it's on that level.
The dialogue was so good, I cried while watching the film.
Perhaps.
It's a classic I have yet to see.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh. Yeah. You know, Ronald Reagan was going to be in that?
Did not.
They recast the whole thing.
The whole thing?
I think so, at least the leads. Like it was a play, and then
I think Dave should have been in it.
You gotta get that time machine built. yeah, I would just say again, like, you know, I'm not like this history buff, but if you give me some, like, I'll learn about something because it's
right.
You know, like, well, like it's a good piece of art, and then you wind up kind of like having your brain in World War One, and then learning about, you know, French society and airplane pilots during World War One, you know, and you know what they ate and what they said and how they joked and what they did when they were prisoners of war, you know.
Yeah, maybe you're like, okay, you're reading the history. Maybe you've seen some documentaries, but here's a drama with showing the humanity of the people in that situation.
Yeah, and that for me is what helps me to learn about something. You know, it's like,
absolutely,
because it's like in The Grand Illusion, you know, if you want to talk about early pilots, you know, in Germany and, you know, it's like, I can just go back to pictures in my head and obviously they come from film. That's how I learn, you know, film is like a great educational tool that doesn't have to be like boring and educational in the sense of boring, but just very rich and just really engages you on so many levels. Interesting ways that they actually cut the film and shot the film, as well as
story.
Oh, yes,
the blocking and the lighting of this, like, great cinematography.
These views of the Alps and so forth. The depiction of German country life. It's just, like, so diverse. Like, you get glimpses into all these worlds and cultures just in a film. But the film.
Would you put any caveats on it?
I don't know. Well, I would say, you know, very general caveats, because, you know, some people don't like to watch movies that have subtitles or that are in black and white. Yeah. So it's like, you know, if you have this interest, then maybe this film is for you, you know, like.
Well, something I might say to somebody is like, okay, this film doesn't have a plot. There's no like structure where it's like, we're going to do this and it's about those people achieving that goal.
Right. Well, I mean, it's there. It's loose, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's so loose.
They try to escape, and then, you know, their captain helps them escape. Yeah. You're right. There's no plot. But, like, I know another guest you've had on the show is Lydia Nightingale, right? Has she been on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know
she's
very versed in things German and things Teutonic.
And she talked to us about Inglourious Bastards.
She's someone who I would say, you know, you should check this movie out if you don't know it. Because it's, you know, very interesting part of, you know, European history and filmmaking. Mm-hmm. I think I could definitely see. And she's, you know, I've seen a play that she wrote that, you know, I think it was World War II. It took place after World War II, right? A short play.
Yep.
But I know that she's the kind of person who would get a lot out of a film like
that. Well, I guess you got to tag her, Dave, in your repost.
Well, you know, another film that I should be making more connections to is like The Great Escape.
Oh.
But not really. It's like I kept thinking, oh, this is like The Great Escape, maybe at the beginning. That's why I started to think. But then as the film went on, that comparison dissolved.
Right.
Because The Great Escape is really, you know, has this sense of rebellion and defiance about it. Whereas this is not about that.
No, you know? It really sort of breaks the mold of all these genres that we keep bringing up, you know, war movies, World War One movies, pilot movies, prison escape movies. He manages to turn that on its head and say, yeah, you have all these different types of movies you could do, but I'm just going to use that as a vehicle to make these observations about society.
About people.
About people, exactly. People in war and the changing world and their experience of it.
Well, it's been great to have you on. I almost said Lydia.
Lydia.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Colleen.
Yes, it's been great to be on. I've never been a guest on a podcast before.
You've never come on to discuss a movie before?
No.
Well, we hope we lived up to your expectations.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. I want to go watch more movies and come talk to you guys about them. I remember I at the last minute, remember, I was like, well, how about instead of Grand Illusion, we could do like Mulholland Drive. That's one of my favorite movies.
We'd love to have you back for Mulholland
okay.
Drive.
Okay. But, and then you were like, well,
I wanted to show Lucas some other David Lynch stuff beforehand.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, these guys are hardcore. They want to talk about Grand Illusion. All right. So I'm glad you persisted with that.
Dave wants to ease me into David Lynch other than Twin Peaks.
Oh, okay. You know, I never watched Twin Peaks. And I wasn't a big fan of Blue Velvet. I don't know. That was all right.
Blue Velvet honestly isn't high on my list either. I really like, I guess my top two would be Eraserhead and Mulholland Drive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Mulholland Drive, it's like my test is, and Grand Illusion passes this test, is if I am willing to watch a movie multiple times, you know, which growing up, I didn't, there were VCRs, but we didn't have one. You couldn't just like replay movies at will, but you know, so.
I was raised on VHS.
Okay. Yeah, we didn't have a black and, we didn't have a color TV till I was like 17, but it wasn't because they weren't invented. Because we weren't spending money on it, that's all. But you know, if you want to see something again, you go to the movies again. So even then, even later, you know, like, once I had DVD player and all of that, I would still, you know, if I saw a movie twice or rented a movie twice or Netflixed it twice, or more, that's the sign that it's on my on my top 10. Grand Illusion, I think, is that. I've never sat down and written down my top 10, but Grand Illusion is on it. Mulholland Drive is on it.
It'd be very hard. I know it's like, this movie's probably somewhere in my top 10.
Right.
But it'd be very difficult for me to actually put numbers to it.
Right.
Because then it's like, all right, these five, and then all these could be like all six.
This other thing is, I think I like French movies.
Yeah.
You know, because I also loved Amélie, and there's this other movie, Tous les matins du monde, All the Mornings of the World, and it's about, it just introduced me to this whole genre of music, classical, sort of like pre-classical, kind of Baroque era music, the music of the viola da gamba. And like after that, like, you know, I just went on that track of listening to all that particular genre of music. Mm-hmm. So like, I just love how a good movie will influence you like that. Like,
yeah, of foreign films, French films really do appeal to me. And I don't know what it is, and I don't know if it's, like, I don't necessarily have a broad perspective of French films, but the French films I've seen, I've really enjoyed. I particularly recommend a film called Rififi, which is a heist film.
Who's the director of that?
Oh, I have no idea.
Some French dude.
Let's see. That would be Jules Dassin.
Okay.
It's Dassin. A film from 1955.
Frenchify that for us.
Dassin.
And so that's like a French noir film. And the other French film that I saw that I really enjoyed was Eyes Without a Face, a horror film.
Oh.
You're losing Colleen here.
No, you're not.
I'm sorry.
No, you're not. I was just like, oh, really? No.
I think the Eyes Without a Face, the director, like, did this documentary about, like, plastic surgery or something, and saw him, like, cutting into people's faces, and it's like, I think I will make a horror film about this.
Inspiration comes in the strangest places.
But it's, like, the weirdest gothic horror film, like, really perverse and really French.
Right. Well, you know, when Grand Illusion was starting, I forget exactly what it said, but it just sort of reminded me that, like, you know, there's actually funding for filmmakers in France, like government funding, like arts grants. It's sometimes probably, you know, a lot of bad movies are made that way too. But I mean, it's really, we live in a culture of, you know, if you're not in the blockbuster world, you're doing Kickstarter campaigns and so forth. And there's really, in other countries, there's, the arts are treated a little bit differently.
And well, even in this country, like, it used to be independents could make films and get them put out in theaters. But because of like home media and stuff, it's like you really can't get an independent film into theaters nowadays unless it's under very specific conditions, limited time engagement, and it has to be a very artsy film that has worked its way up. Whereas like in the old days, Roger Corman could put out a movie. It would be in the theaters and it would compete and many times outdo movies put out by the major studios. And that just can't happen today.
Independents end up turning to the internet instead. Trying to get things going.
You don't know anything about that, right?
No, not at all.
Well, we're heading on to our adventure of discussing movies that are like Alien, but came out before Alien. Because Alien has been accused of taking direct influences a lot over the years.
Not from any Italian films, huh?
What were we going for? It's like,
from an Italian film.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Yes, there was an Italian film called Planet of the Vampires, which, why don't we cover that one next, Lucas?
Sure, Dave. We'll cover Planet of the Vampires.
How do you say vampire in Italian? I wonder. I vampiri, probably.
Vampire. I don't know.
And that's actually a Mario Bava film.
Oh, well, then that's good. I like Mario Bava. You know who else likes Mario Bava? Matt.
Of course. I think the original Italian title was Terror in Space because it says original title, Terror nello Spazio. Terror nello Spazio.
I wish I spoke Italian. It's such a great language. It's so fun just to say Terror nello Spazio.
Spazio.
That reminds me of the guy in A Fish Called Wanda. He doesn't speak a word of Italian, so he just says, like, Italian food.
Yeah. Pasta linguine, fettuccine.
So I'm really looking forward to that. And also, I'm totally obsessed. Alien is one of my top 10 films. I'm totally obsessed with it. I've read both versions of the script. It's just one of those films that it's constantly captures my attention. So seeing, you know, how this came together, especially having read the first draft, you can really see the influence to some of these movies that it was taking from. And they've admitted to some of them. They've admitted to Planet of the Vampires. I think they admitted to It, the Terror from Beyond Space, and an episode of Doctor Who inspiring them. But I think Planet of the Vampires was one that they always denied inspired them.
It's a coincidence.
We'll be the judge of that next week.
All right.
Send them on their way, Lucas.
Well, Jellyheads, thanks for listening to this episode of No U-Turn to the Drive. We've been your host, Lucas Wilson, and
Dave, with our guest,
Colleen Lovett.
If you enjoyed what you listened to, may I suggest you go to our website at psychojellyfish.com to find this and other podcasts. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and the podcast app Stitcher. Please rate and review. It really does help with the show. If you're a fan, you want to help spread the madness, give us a like at facebook.com/psychojellyfish. Follow us at Twitter at Jellycast. And with your thoughts, words, comments, or questions, please send them our way in the comments section.
It's been a fun one, folks.
Keep it psycho. I liked the last third because then I could practice my German more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Lotte hast blaue Augen.
Yeah, that was stuck in my head for like a few days. Her just going, blaue Augen. Yeah, right. It was just stuck in my head.
And then the French girl's like, blue Augen. She's like, no, blaue Augen.
It's like, no, blaue. Plural words are female.
Oh, didn't know that.
There's three genders in German.
Oh, wow. Just like the guy was explaining, one prisoner was explaining to the other, oh, you know, Russian, it declines just like Latin does. Complex.